Welcome again to Sports Doc DC in episode 2, and this is a big one. Season 3 is going to be a little bit different, as I've talked about, and today we are going to get to the nuts and bolts about how to use information. And in fact, I think we need to start with that. The word information is the problem, and that's where I've really gone wrong with this site and this podcast. Right now, it's just another information page. I like to listen to a lot of stuff that comes from government agencies, stuff like things like CIA, Spycraft, FBI, Homeland Security, and they often talk about, like, we don't need more information, we need intel, we need intelligence, and intel is different. Intel is actionable. A person with intel can now make decisions because they have the whys, they have an understanding, they have a mechanism. I don't want this just to be another information page, because if you've ever listened to me before, or even if you're new to the show, there's tons of information pages out there. You can basically look up anything you want on the internet and it will be there. That's information. Hey, what's the best stretch should I do for tight hamstrings? Or should you even do a stretch for tight hamstrings, right? You can look up anything. You can look up, is Donald Trump the best president in the world? Is he the worst president in the world? You're gonna get an equal number of sites because everyone can spit out their own information. Intel's different. Intel's actionable. That's what I wanna give you. A better understanding, a mechanism. And that's what season 3 is all about. Now, before we get into how do you use all these different tools that are available in modern medicine, things like cupping, things like stabilizers versus muscle strength, you know, when to stretch, when to use a foam roller, tack balls, how to do like these metal tools and scraping. I think it's more important and super necessary to get the basic concepts. And today's episode is going to be modern concepts that you can use to help make your decision making. So join along, listen to a quick ad, and let's get you back in the game. And today we're going to cover modern body concepts. One of the things that I think we get wrong in the sports performance world is a lot of times we're just stuck repeating what the coaches before us told us. It sounds good. It's a great idea. It made sense when we were doing it. Now we're doing it. But the problem is, if you're an early 2000s kid, you grew up with a coach that was about my age. So he's getting information that was probably back from the late 70s or 80s. If we're still doing that information 50 years later, we're way behind the curve. And if there's anything that the Sports Doc DC website is about getting modern, updated information, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, things have just flipped over upside down its head. And it is so tough for me seeing my own kids being trained the way I was trained years ago. The information's out there. The intel is out there. Why do we keep doing things not so much wrong, but just in an old, outdated, old-fashioned manner? There's better stuff. So today I want to talk about some of these major concepts, and I'm going to get right down into it. When you have these things, you can create a better flow chart. So you have not just options, but better ideas. You can run experiments. You can make better decision making. Things like, oh, I tried this and it worked, so that means this. Or I tried this, it didn't work. What else should I try? Because what I see happening, especially with the athletic performance world and guys like me that are very type A, think of like CrossFitters, triathletes, marathoners. We just want more, more. So if you have this idea of like, hey, I go to this doctor and he's awesome because he really works my muscles out deep. And then he also puts cups on me. And then they run tape on me. And then they go in there with their elbow. And then they can crack and pack and pop my back. You're just getting everything. And your body basically has dyslexia at this point. It doesn't know what the hell is going on, so it basically shuts down or gets nothing out of it. And I know that might seem weird. That's because a lot of us, especially any of you guys listening to this, are type A people. But the problem is, more is almost always a terrible idea. It's just bad. We don't want more. I hear people say every day, well, I use heat and ice both. And I'm like, why? Like, what mechanism makes you want to do heat and ice both unless you're trying to flush a system? I see it for treating an injury, and it's just a bad way. I see people take the metal tools and scrape themselves until they are bruised, which would be a compression, and then they put purple hickeys on themselves with cups, thinking like the more bruising they have is going to speed up the way they're healing. And it just doesn't make sense. I don't dislike the cups. I don't dislike the tools. I use them every single day in my office. But there has to be an understanding of what you're trying to get out of it. So let's just jump right into it. The first concept I want to talk about is what's called upregulation or downregulation. The old way of looking at tight muscles was tight muscles need to relax. You need to stretch them out. You need to warm them up. You need to loosen them up. And hopefully by now you realize that that is a super outdated, old-fashioned kind of 1990s way of looking at muscle tension. I know I've talked about it many times, but I was surprised about a month ago. I was lecturing to a bunch of kinesiology students at the university, and they just hadn't heard that it was different. Well, here's my wake-up call for you guys. It's different. We no longer just stretch out and loosen up tight muscles. Basically, when you have a tight muscle in your body, you have one of four or five things going on. And the modern approach is, let's figure out why you are tight. So that concept is called threat. You know, basically every body part reacts differently to a threat. If you sprain your ankle, your brain recognizes it is threatened and it does what it does. In the ankle, it tends to just swell up. Everyone's had a sprained ankle, it's swollen. That's not how the rest of the body works. If you look around, like along the spine, and what happens if you have like a disc strain? What happens if you have a rib issue? What happens if you have a crick in the neck? You get this incredible muscle spasm. The body doesn't want to do swelling like it does in the ankle along the spine. There's too many nerves that come out of there, and any kind of swelling like that that could put compression on a nerve, I mean, those nerves are going to body parts, they're going to organs, they're giving the brain a ton of information. So the brain's not willing to sacrifice immobilization with edema and swelling to these areas. So it does what it does. It locks the muscles up as tight as it can as a protection mechanism. The muscle spasm that you get when you have a crick in the neck or when you have a bad low back, that's not the problem. That's the body's way of mitigating a threat. A tight low back, that is your brain's way of saying, I don't want you going bowling today because I'm not sure what's going on. All right, and the shoulder, it happens like this as well. If you have any injury to the shoulder, basically the brain's way of trying to stabilize that and keep it from moving because it's not sure what's wrong yet is to take your pec muscle and to lock it down tight. So if it locks it down, it kind of puts your arm into an internal rotation. Think of like if you're wearing a sling. Remember back in the 1990s when people would hurt their shoulder and they'd wear a sling? Well, we all know like slings are a bad idea, but that's the protection mechanism. So when I see someone come into my clinic or when I'm out at the university and I'm working on one of the athletes and they're not having good shoulder motion, they have pain, I first assess, do they have a tight pec? Because a tight pec is the protection mechanism and you have to fix that. So knowing just that concept itself, knowing threat and that different body parts react different. And if you want to get deeper into this, I've written an entire other podcast article on this site called Different Treatments for Different Reactions. You can look that stuff up and go deep with it, but just get the idea of threat. Now, we realize that we've got a tight muscle. We need to do something about it. So if it is a short contracted muscle, think of like a bicep flexing, and you want to relax it, we're looking for a term or a concept called downregulation. The muscles are on, they're excited, they're turned on. The muscle fibers are shortened, and we want to kind of relax it. So we want to do downregulation. We want those muscle fibers to loosen up. There's also the protection spasm where the muscles kind of get locked in an elongation. So this time, instead of thinking of a bicep flexed, when I teach this as a lecture, I just have people take their arms out wide and hold it stabilized, right? A short bicep is tight, you can feel it, but a long bicep is also tight. So just getting this idea of like tight muscles or a massage therapist or a chiropractor or a PT saying, hey, your muscles are tight, doesn't tell me anything. Is it short? Or is it long? Is it just like splinting? All right, so a lot of times on these splinted long muscles, we wanna do what's called upregulation. We wanna turn the muscle back on. We wanna shorten muscle fibers so that it puts the muscle into the correct position and allows for better movement, because those are definitely performance enhancers, but they're also a great way to treat an injury. So understand this idea of upregulation and downregulation, because that's going to be our goal for almost all of these other applications. So if you're taking something like a Graston tool, and you guys should be familiar with Graston tools, they've been around for over a decade in like regular use, where kind of everybody uses them. Those are those shiny metal tools. And you get in there, and they used to have gua sha tools, which were made of bone or made of a different rock or made of plastic. Those are fine too, but nothing works as well as these metal tools. I actually have a super funny story about this, and it wasn't like I was completely blacklisted from working on the Olympic team, but when my wife and I were really hot into the sports medicine game, and before we had kids, we were looking at getting involved with more with like the Olympic teams and on these NCAA events and showing up and being like these traveling sports doctors that would work with it. And one of the guys that was kind of in charge of placing chiropractors kept telling me, hey, you got to get good with these tools. And I said, man, we use them all the time. Well, what tools are you using? Are you using the Factor, the FAKTR tools? Are you using Graston tools? Are you doing the hot grips? No, we're just using our gua sha tools. And he's like, dude, you got to get better with these metal tools. Well, it upset me because he was the owner of one of the metal tool groups. So to me, I thought it was kind of more of an ethical issue. You know, he's going to make me use his tools or he's going to kind of blacklist me. So I didn't throw like a huge national stink. I mean, I've never been that popular, but I definitely threw a stink up on, I am not going to cave into this guy's stuff. Well, obviously we didn't make the traveling team for the chiropractors. And about a year later, I try the metal tools out for the first time. And I'm like, oh God, these are a billion times better. Like if you guys are still stuck using gua sha because it's cheaper, those metal tools aren't $2,000 or $3,000 anymore like they were when I got started. I mean, I think our first set of Graston tools were probably, I'd say $4,000 or $5,000. I think our first set of Factor tools were probably right up there, $2,000 or $3,000. I think the Hawk grips were like that. There's so many of these tools now. There's so many different shapes and sizes. I mean, Rock Tape makes a really affordable metal tool, but the difference you will feel on somebody's like adhesions and fascia and skin tension, it's amazing the vibration you get. If you haven't taken the time and just got honest with yourself that it's a better tool, it's a much better tool. The problem is the concepts have changed, right? We're now trying to get up regulation versus down regulation. When they first came out and we started getting really good with these things 10, 15 years ago, it basically was, we're trying to break up binding and fascia. Basically, we look at it as like the muscle and the skin and the different layers of muscle, they're all surrounded by this fascia tissue. Right? And if the fascia tissue isn't allowing the muscles to slide and glide over each other like it's supposed to, it's kind of bound together. Well, it's basically like the two different muscles are glued together. That's an adhesion. And we're trying to break up adhesion. So all of us in all these different professions loved grabbing these tools and just getting in there and hammering people. People were left black and blue. They would feel a little bit better. You'd come back 4 or 5 times. And it was really career changing for us. The entire health industry started changing because of these tools. But guys, it's been 10 years now. It's been 12 years. It's been 15 years. Like we've been doing this stuff for a long time. There's a better way. You don't have to get in there and just break up adhesion all the time. Now, we can still use that. If you've been in a boot because you've had a stress fracture and you've been in a boot for 5 weeks, yeah, you're going to have some adhesion that has to break up. It's just a fast-forwarded way of getting back to full recovering from full motion, but not everything's adhesion. You can use those tools in a way for down regulation where it's a little bit deeper pressure. And the way they're kind of teaching it now is if I was going to put pressure on you with one of those tools, it's a 7 out of 10. Right? It's not a 15 out of 10, tell me where the treasure's buried, this is my torture device. It's a 7 out of 10. It's a nice, comfortable, tolerable pressure, and it's very slow, solid strokes. Right? You're going deep on a muscle, and it's a nice, slow, solid stroke the direction the muscle goes. That would be down regulation, and typically we teach down regulation as, you know, 90 to 120 seconds. Let's decrease a muscle tension. Let's get in there. Let's work on adhesion and let's try to get this stuff sliding, gliding. But what if in the different case or the case that I see with like the glutes all the time, people have an inactive glutes because they sit too much. If I'm going to use those tools to try to turn on a muscle, to activate a muscle, to wake them up so they start working again, I want up regulation. upregulation is much more superficial. It's not deep tension. It's low tension, and I go very, very fast. I use multiple directions. I cover it all over the body. I go 90 degrees, 45 degrees, 15 degrees, very, very fast. A lot of times I'll have them actively moving their muscle too. So if I'm working the butt, I'll have them standing or laying down. They're making their muscle flex on and off while I'm hammering this really, really fast and very superficial. It's excitatory. It's upregulation. It's turning the muscle on. And the time for this is 30 seconds or less. You really don't want to go past 30 seconds if you're trying to get upregulation. So I want you to understand those terms of upregulation versus downregulation. If you're not sure how to do that, I've got tons of information on this site about it. I've got videos on how to do this stuff. But also, just for a minute, think if it's not working the way you expect it to, try something different. If you're doing down regulation and an adhesion breakup, and you've done this for 4 or 5 sessions, let's say as an athletic trainer or PT or sports chiropractor, and you're not getting the results you want, it's not working, man. This stuff should work that fast. It drives me insane when I go in an athletic training room and I see some kid that's the star basketball player and he has had a low back issue for 3 months. It's a really easy for an athletic trainer or a physio or a doctor or a sports chiropractor, whatever your job is, a practitioner, let's just say, for a practitioner to say, well, he's not doing his homework. He's not doing his stretches. He's not doing anything. Nothing should take this long. These are geared up athletes. You should have responses really within the same visit. You should at least see a change, but you should never get where you're okay with 4 or 5 visits and you're not seeing something. If you are, it's time for a different game plan, right? This is the flow chart I'm talking about. All right, this guy presents with this issue. I'm gonna try what I think is the best modality for him. Did it work? Yes, no. And there's a different line for a different flow chart. We all had these when we were going through grad school. Don't forget them. That's the way you should still be practicing. A flow chart's not an outdated way to teach something. That is what you have to get results. So anyway, guys, that's up and down regulation with the idea of a threat. I hope that makes sense. We're gonna next get into body mapping. I think that's another concept you have to have before all these other ideas make sense. The next concept we're gonna talk about is body mapping. Now, body mapping is just kind of cool. This stuff's been around for a while. I think it really probably hit its heyday kind of in the 1960s and 70s, and it was in the psychology realm. It was the idea of the homunculus. And if you haven't seen a homunculus, when you get a chance, I want you to look it up online. This is a thing that we all learned in undergrad and grad, but I really, the last few years as I've been lecturing to college kids, they just have never seen it before. The homunculus is basically this giant representation of how the brain sees the body. So areas that have more neural sensation, things that we pay attention to, like our fingertips, our lips, our tongue, you know, you can feel a piece of salt on your tongue. You could pick up a grain of sand with your fingertips and feel it. They are higher represented. Our organ systems, our sexual organs are definitely heightened sensation. So it's kind of the way the brain sees the body. Now, I think it's a little bit outdated. I have an entire article dedicated to body mapping that I think explains it really, really well. But the idea is, you know, let's talk about threat again. If you have an injury, let's say to your elbow, and the brain gets this idea of threat, in a way, it kind of shuts down the information that's going in there. When I explain it in my other article, I talk about like it's a Google Maps and you've got a bad Wi-Fi signal. Things are sort of pixelated. The intel is not coming in the right way. So one of the ways you can certainly affect pain, especially when it's not following a standard way that we learn about the human body in America, is like, okay, this is the bicep. It's got this origin. It's got this insertion. It's got this the nervy innervation. That's how we kind of learn stuff. But what happens when a kid comes to you or an athlete comes to you and says, hey, doc, my whole arm hurts, and they kind of rub this area up and down their bicep, tricep, on the outside of their elbow, down to their forearm. I mean, you're looking at 3 or 4 different nerves. You're looking at maybe 10 different muscles. Like, what's going on? Well, I think the body mapping concept really, really was a significant change and something that really worked well in my office that I just, I'll tell you, man, I wasn't into it. It kind of came up to me as kind of like one of these hippy dippy ideas, and oh, that's not the way it's going. But I'm telling you, the more I play with this, the more information that keeps coming out in research, it's a very huge concept and a really huge tool for your body. You can use basically anything, man. You can do upregulation, you can do downregulation, you can use scratchy sensation, you can use these little plastic tools. We've got some things called smudge tools, which are like a silicone, they're ultra sticky. Things like the voodoo band, the flossing band, that's a great way to get body mapping. Basically, you're taking this large area of the body and you're giving it sensation. Some way or another, you're giving it sensation, and the brain now has to pay attention to the area better. And if it's not under threat, well, the brain's getting better information. It realizes, okay, hey, maybe I overreacted. We don't have to have these things so locked up, and it lets the pain go away. It's just a super cool concept, and it's really, really easy to use. And I'll tell you, the more and more research that comes out, and especially the guys from Rock Tape, if you're into this stuff, Rock Tape talks about how the skin is the map of the body. The skin is our GPS in humans. We gotta have this working the right way. And the more information we can give it, the better map it is and the better the brain can understand it. And I'll tell you, it's a funny thing when I start really looking at body mapping and the way the brain perceives injury and pain. And I'll tell you where it really came to light that we're onto something huge here is, even though I've been doing this for 20 years, when I go and talk to any like public group, but even when I go up to like the hospital settings and I'm working with orthopedic surgeons and I'm working with these top, you know, trauma nurses, or I'm working on sports team that has like this hierarchy of all of us, there's a big argument about heat and ice. Because you know, I'm huge into, if you are inflamed, you cannot use heat. If you have inflammation somewhere and you're using heat, more blood comes to the area. And basically your brain sees that excess blood as, oh crap, something's even worse than it was before. And then it goes into whatever the way it treats threats. So if, let's say you've got a sore shoulder, you've got some sort of injury in your shoulder and there's inflammation in there, and you're throwing a hot pack on there trying to loosen up the shoulder, more blood comes to the area. If it's a light-skinned athlete, you'll know it because the skin gets red. And the brain says, oh crap, it's inflamed more than it was. Well, we got to lock it down even tighter. And you create this like never-ending circle. So I'm really big into like know when to use ice and when not to. And there's still some old school medical guys that just don't like the fact I'm a chiropractor. They can't get past my label. They don't care about what information I'm peddling. They care that I'm a chiropractor and I'm an enemy. So they will often point out to me like, okay, you're using ice on these low backs that are really sore. Are you telling me that you think that ice is penetrating deep enough that it's taking inflammation off a disc? I think it's a very valid question. I mean, one of my best friends that's an athletic trainer has talked about that a million times. Do you really think the ice is getting deep enough that it's getting inside that Taylor joint and it's taking the inflammation off? Well, here's my answer. No, it's not. The ice pack, it gives you a sensation on your skin. The skin is the map, and the brain can now get a better picture of a larger area than one specific thing. Well, why couldn't you just use heat then? If you're just looking for a bigger picture, man, most of the hot packs are bigger because heat brings more blood to the area and that screws up everything. So I'm huge into ice, but I don't think the ice is doing the anti-inflammation we think it's actually doing. Ice pack is not the same as a cortisone shot. It's not the same as taking an anti-inflammatory like Advil or Aleve, but you're getting the body map to work for you and you're doing it in a way that doesn't have increased blood. I think electric stimulation works like that. I have seen a huge decrease in the use of electric stim. But yet, ask any athlete that's ever had it on what they think, and they love it, man. Unless they've had just some idiot crank them up so high that that hurts, you can use that electric stim as a body mapping idea. And I'll tell you, and I'm honest with this, the guys from Rock Tape will 100% back this up. That is the way modern taping is being looked at. It used to be like my wife and I were one of the first ones to get trained in how to use kinesio tape. And it was really big on, well, if you run it this way, it makes a muscle stronger. It's upregulation. If you run it this way, it's downregulation. There's been, you know, 20 years of research on this. And basically what they're saying is, you know what, guys? All these things that we have, they work. They just work for a different reason. And why they're working is body mapping. That rock tape probably isn't making a muscle stronger or isn't shutting it down and making it relax. What it's doing is giving your brain a bigger picture, right? It's on the skin. The skin has way more nerves in it than the muscles do. And now the brain gets a better map and it says, hey, there's probably not the threat we thought it was. Let's let it move the right way. And if you think it's just junk, if you're just one of those guys that's like, hey, do you believe in tape or do you not believe in tape? Well, then you're behind the times. You're practicing like an old school doctor, an old school trainer. None of this stuff I want you guys to believe in or not believe in. I want you to understand how it works so that you can make better decisions. So that's the idea of body mapping. I can go really deep with this. I have on a different article. So make sure you check out body mapping because that's a key concept for a lot of this as we get later into it in the season on how we use these things. The other key concept that I think you have to understand is the joint-by-joint approach. Now, I also have an article about this, so if you want to get a little bit deeper, get with it. But if you are one of the guys that's like my age and you're practicing and you are not very familiar with the joint-by-joint approach, you're going to be way behind the times when you get to some of these seminars. Joint-by-joint approach, it doesn't work for everything. It's just another way of looking at the body. Basic idea on this is that every joint is stacked in the body, every body area, by a mobile joint and a stable joint. And I think this is one of the things that chiropractors and PTs most definitely have to get modern with. I mean, take my profession, for example. We're chiropractors. We're fantastic at moving everything. But the thing is, like, if the ankle is mobile and the knee is stable, the hip is mobile, the low back is stable, the upper back is mobile, take it through the upper body, shoulder's mobile, elbow's pretty stable, the wrist is mobile. If you have pain in a stable joint, such as a knee, you better be looking at, is there a decrease in mobility at the joints above and below? And of course, as we start playing with this in my practice, it becomes incredibly obvious. If you're having knee pain, barring an injury, such as like an ACL, man, it's coming from the ankle. It's coming from the hip. And it's even progressed to the point where, like, damn near everything's coming from the hip. So understand that joint by joint approach. I don't want to get really, really deep into it, but you've got to get it. You can't just sit there and put more mobility in a lower back. Chiropractors can't just keep cracking backs and let me put you on your side and twist you. I know it makes for a cool TikTok video, but it's not helping people. If they have lost the stability there, you can't just keep adding more mobility and thinking somehow the body's gonna magically like repair itself and get stable. The same things with neck problems, right? I hear every day in my office some desk worker, especially women, that say, I hold all my tension up here, and they point to their traps. Look, if you're holding all your tension in your traps, it's probably because your shoulders aren't working the right way, or your shoulder blades aren't working the right way, or your upper neck's not moving the right way. But most likely, that's not what it is. That's why getting a massage every week hasn't changed anything for a year. That's why coming to the chiropractor every week hasn't changed anything for a year. Your neck needs to get stable. And it's different than strength. So that's another concept I'm just going to throw right in here. Strength is not the same as stability. The way I teach it on my lectures is if I had a 50-pound dumbbell and I was doing standing lateral flies for strength training, all right? Now, 50 pounds is a lot for a lateral shoulder, but that's mainly working the medial delt, right? Everyone can understand that. You all have that kind of that basic understanding of how strength works. If I'm using a lateral fly standing, I'm trying to increase strength on my lateral delt. If I grabbed a 6-pound weight and I held it straight out in that same position but wasn't doing any movement, well, that's now stability. And stability is not one muscle. That's not the medial delt that's the only thing going right now. There's probably 70 muscles, and I would say the counter side, like the opposite side, like glute medius complex and what your grandpa would refer to as the trunk, that's what's probably doing the majority of the work. So when you're going to train stability, there cannot be movement. I love Joe Rogan's iron neck that he promotes a lot. I think that is great for muscle strength through the neck, but that isn't making the neck more stable. It's making it stronger. For stability, you need something that doesn't have movement. So we use this little stable ball. You lean it into it on a wall and don't move your neck. That's how you increase stability in the neck. The trouble is, in my clinic, I have sold probably 5,000 of those little stability balls. They're like $10 compared to Joe Rogan's Iron Neck, which, what, $400 or $500? It's not as cool. People don't like doing stability, but it is a missing link in our sports performance. And if there's anything that, if me looking into the future and saying what is going to be one of the major changes in sports performance, looking for wins on the field and court, the strength and conditioning coaches are going to start implementing stability. And here's why I think that. When you go to make a tackle in football, if you have strength, you've probably got a little bit more mass. That's a good thing. But if you don't have stability, you're still going to tackle the opposing player. But the opposing player is probably going to have momentum and is going to go forward. If you have more stability, the player that you just tackled isn't going to move forward. They're going to move directly lateral, tackled maybe a yard shorter than what they would have got with their momentum. And if the stability is completely solid, well, maybe they even go backwards a little bit. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, but how many times in football does the decision-making come down to it is third and a half a yard versus third and a yard and a half? It changes the call selection. It changes the probabilities and the numbers. And the analytics in the professional sports world are starting to get this good. The next big career that I see taking off, and something that I would just absolutely love to be a part of, is how to use these physical attributes to make even more precise analytics. You know, I love watching like NBA basketball, but you can tell when someone has a sore back. When they have a sore back, their reaction time goes down. If the reaction time is more from one side to the other side, well, now you can attack the guy's slower side. A tenth of a second in basketball is 2 feet, and I'm a terrible basketball player, but you give me 2 feet on somebody, I can get a shot. That's coming down the pipe, and it's all coming from things like this, the joint by joint approach. So get modern, understand these ideas. And a special shout out for all you guys that are working in the sports performance world. Like what I want to do, what I think everyone that joins athletic training, nearly nobody gets into athletic training in college thinking, oh, I want to work on hot backs, or I want to tape ankles, or I want to make sure when the guy's injured, I can help him out. We're all trying to get in there and increase performance. Right, I went into sports chiropractic and felt like I was kind of one of the founders in this profession or the direction that profession was going, because I wanted to make young kids be able to have an increased vertical jump. I want them to make the varsity team a year earlier. I want them to get the scholarships that they otherwise wouldn't. I want performance stuff. This is where performance happens. That's why these decisions are so much more important than scraping somebody with a tool. So that's a joint by joint approach. Stable joints need more stability. Mobile joints may need more mobility, but let's look and see what's happened. You guys that have listened to me for any time at all understand I always come back to the hip. The hip has got the glute muscles with it. It's got the quads attached. It's got the hamstrings attached. It's got the back attached. It's got the trunk. That thing is the primary engine of the body. If it's not moving the right way, nothing in sports performance world is going to work the right way. You're behind the X to begin with because the hip's not moving the right way. Let's make sure it's got the proper amount of mobility. All right, we're going to move on one more concept and I'll keep going. I know this one's getting long, but this is the baseline for all of season 3. And like I said, I'm kind of following Dr. Huberman's idea with the Huberman Lab. He gets into some deep discussion. I feel like I sat through a college lecture every time I listen to his podcast. And you're going to see season 3 kind of get more into this idea. Use the stuff you use. Use the stuff you like. If you don't like this stuff, don't use it. But at least I'm trying to give you something else to experiment with. This last concept is a real key one, especially for all of you guys that are sports-based practitioners that work with injury. So this summer, I was just blessed to be in the lecture circuit with what I think is one of the great sports strength and conditioning coaches out there. And it was kind of funny. He threw it together. I was on vacation. He threw it together. Hey, will you do this lecture with us? I got a bunch of these high school, college basketball coaches, and we're just kind of letting them know what our ideas are. So, yeah, you know, I want to be a lecturer for something like that. But I also sat through the rest of the program, rather than just doing my hour and getting out of there. So my hour-long lecture, hour-and-a-half-long lecture was pretty much the death of the warm-up, right? It doesn't mean I don't like warm-up, but you guys can look up. I have that as a podcast already. You can look up my idea of the modern warm-up. It's based on my tier of recovery after injury and how I think you build a better athlete. So as we get into this, just get the idea. The way I explain this to my 14-year-old is we've all got this God-given potential. Look at it as work capacity. It's a giant pyramid of if everything works out right in your life and you perform and train and get the mindset, here's the peak of what you can get to with your performance. And then everything should be based on that, because if you're not doing the right exercise program, your base is smaller. Your peak can't go as high. It's the work capacity pyramid that guys like Ross Edgley talk about, how to increase your work capacity. So I always explain that to young athletes as the pyramid, and they each have to have bases. Now, I'm a 1990s, early 2000 guy, right? I was a college football player. And to summarize, as a college football player in that era, we just assumed that more mass made you a better football player. More strength equaled more mass. So a typical thing that I would be asked on a Monday walking into the weight room from our coaches was, hey, Pete, how much are you weighing? How much is your bench press? How much is your squat? Right? That was all good and valid data for the late 90s. But it's just super outdated. I think it makes for bigger, stronger players, but not necessarily better football players. The modern era needs to be, how do we get W's? How do we get wins? So that was kind of my idea. So I want you to get this tier that we're looking at. And here's how the tier works. If you have an injury, the first thing that you need to start fixing is the threat. If there's inflammation and there's a threat, like we talked about 20 minutes ago, that has to be taken into account first. And why that's important is we all want to jump right into these exercises and these recovery ideas like range of motion and increased strength. But if that is a fresh threat and you're doing strength exercises or range of motion exercises trying to make the athlete get on the court better, and your brain sees that as a threat, you are doing a disservice to your athlete. You're actually making recovery slower because you're continually starting over at day one. Now, when I present this, I think sometimes people are like, oh, he doesn't like recovery. He just like hates everything. He's just super unconventional. No, there's definitely a time for range of motion. There's definitely a time for muscle strength. I just think if it works in a pattern, you get better, faster results that are more long-lasting, and it decreases your chance of, one, re-injury, which I think everybody in the sports practitioner world is pretty good at. You guys don't get a lot of re-injury. What we do get is slow, stagnant. They're not recovering. And then we tend to think, well, they're just not doing their rehab enough. We got to give them more. That's what this whole article is about. So I have as another podcast, one that you guys should go back and look at. It was an infographic that I built on your return, not so much the return to play. I think the return to play is another good concept you guys have to have. If you don't have it implemented, you have to have that, but more the tier, how it goes. So it's one infographic and it works up. I originally made the picture to look like the old chutes and ladder game from our youth. You know, if you do this and it screw it up, you go all the way back to the beginning. Well, my kids don't understand shooting ladders. They don't understand what that is. So I made it just kind of a roadmap. So it's called the Roadmap to Recovery. Threat is on the bottom. You have to get that fixed first. And then I think where I got the idea of not doing a warm-up is after the threat's kind of under control, or at least you've got an idea of what's going on, then you need proper movement. The mobile joints need to move the right way. So if you're just getting into strength training and, oh my God, this guy blew out his ACL, we got to make his squat better, we got to make his range of motion better. Here's the trouble with that. If I am sent a video of a kid doing a squat, how do I know what muscles he's activating? All right, so I want to take you back again, like I just said, to my 1990s way of doing a squat. The coach would say, How much are you squatting, Chad? Well, coach, I'm squatting 315. Good, I want to get you to 330. Basically, what I would do is just squeeze my shoulders together tighter, push a little bit harder, or maybe turn my toes out. Bam, I'm up to 330 in a week. But did I activate the right muscles? Am I making myself a better athlete just by learning how to squat more? And that was where, when I got in this summer lecture this year, those strength coaches that I worked with really opened my eyes up. So here was the concept they gave me. They said with their college athletes, if they're going to have an athlete do a bench press to increase their pec muscle activation, they really don't care about the weight. What they care about is, does that athlete make that muscle contract fully? More of a bodybuilder idea. We don't care so much how much weight you can move. It's, are you making your muscle work? And what they would give them, at least with the guys I worked with, is at the end of their set, was it green, yellow, or red? What was the level of intensity, and did you feel like that worked the whole muscle? That to me was genius. Pure genius. Because otherwise, we're just looking at what's the result. The same with how much they squat, the same with how much they bench. You know, I love to assess a squat. When someone comes in my office with almost any injury, I will have them squat. I love to assess it. But the trouble is, we're humans. We can compensate so easily and make that squat look good by using the wrong techniques. And that doesn't work as well. I don't care so much on rehab, like, is your squat working the right way? I care about, like, are you using the right muscles in the right order? Because that's what gives maximum ability, and that's what's going to create more W's. So that works for range of motion and movement too. One of my favorite, you know, I got rid of the term warm-up. One of my favorite mobilizations for the hip is these big standing hip circles. But we all have been doing those for 30 years as part of a warm-up. The problem is it's a warm-up. It's half-assed. It can't be just I did 20 hip circles. It has to be you did 20 perfect hip circles in a way that made your hip open up and move the right way to get the proper blood flow, to get the proper mechanics, and train your brain that this is a safe movement and this is a proper movement. That's the stuff that counts. It has to be done the right way, and all that takes is a little explanation. So my tier of recovery goes like that. Mitigate the threat. Then we get movement. And then we get into activation, and activation is key. Activation is similar to strength, but it's not strength. And I think it's the same way as the idea that I gave you about using a lateral shoulder raise for muscle strength versus holding a lateral muscle, holding a lateral weight for stability. Activation is your brain's ability to find the muscle. Specifically for what I do in my office 1,000 times is the glutes. Athletes can just not find their glute. And if you cannot find your glute and you cannot find your glute medius specifically, well, no problem. Your low back's going to take care of it. But that's why there's so many low back injuries and there's just so much low back pain in athletes. It's not because they're doing something improper. They're doing the proper mechanics. They're just using the wrong muscle to get into that shape. Right? So I want that to make sense to you. Activation is about finding the right muscle. Put your hand on it. Is it actually flexing? When I show my athletes at the university, I want you to do these little butt kicks with your hand on your butt. They immediately think I need to put 20 pounds on my squat. And like, before you put 20 pounds on your squat, why don't we actually find the butt with no weight? Can you flex your butt cheek like Nicki Minaj in a rap video? Can you make it twerk? Because if you've got that kind of control, if you've got that activation, now when we go to add strength, you're actually getting what you want. If you would have had me put this lecture together 4 years ago, I would have told you strength was the number one component. It's what's missing in all the world. We need strength. We need strength. I did this on the lecture circuit for 10 years. It's about strength. That's the most important. That's what you got to have. I'm totally the other way now. I'm totally the other way. You have to have mobility in the mobile joints first. You have to have stability in the stable joints second, and then you have to have activation first. Because if you don't have those three components, your strength component is going to put you back into threat. You're not getting what you can get out of it. the strength component comes only after activation. I still think strength is insanely important. I think endurance is insanely important. I think acceleration, I think balance, I think strategies, those are all key concepts to winning, but it has to be done after the threat's mitigated, the movement's the right way, and the patient or the athlete is aware of their activation. And that is the tier of recovery. Guys, I'm going to stop that. We've got a very long, the longest podcast I've ever done. That's the basic concepts that are going to be a part of every single follow-up for the rest of season three when we get into how specifically to use cups. And I'm not going to go back and reiterate this every time, or we're going to end up with these hour-long podcasts, which, you know, I love Huberman's stuff. I think that's why I'm so enthralled by him. Like, it's a classroom lecture. But I don't want to have to repeat all of these every time. I want to be able to go back and be like, understand the key concept of this, the key concept of that. So get these ideas, get it down. This is going to be a fun journey. And I'll tell you, this is exciting for me. This is the stuff I would love to do with my career. So don't hesitate to reach out and say, hey, man, I'd like to learn a little bit more about this, or here's an idea I think you should bring up. It was pretty cool, not to bring up Huberman, but I've just been enthralled by his stuff. And a month ago, I said, I love the one you did on marijuana. It changed my entire idea about how marijuana worked on the body. I guess I had just forgotten how it worked on the neural network. I didn't understand how alcohol worked. I didn't understand how nicotine works. So I just sent him a little text and I said, hey, man, what about one on caffeine? Well, sure enough, he sends one on a caffeine this week, and it's just changed everything. So I'm telling you, it's a modern era. You can reach out and talk to me if you want to learn something, man. I'm here to help present this stuff. If you want it more in a one-on-one fashion, yeah, I'm not sure what direction I want to go with my career, but I don't think it's just going to be sitting in the chiropractic office anymore. I definitely want to get more on the lecture circuit and that. So don't hesitate to reach out and say, hey, can we get you, can we book you for an appearance? I'd be happy to do it, guys. This is going to be a neat and fun year. I'm looking really forward to, you know, season number three with you guys on Sports.DC. Take care, y'all. Appreciate everything you've done for me to help it grow. Please don't hesitate to share this with some of your like-minded people and help me spread the word. I appreciate where we're going with all of this. It's a lot of fun. Wow, what a mouthful. That was a monster. We went through a ton of key concepts. So I'll tell you, this is the stuff that runs my clinic. I've had a very successful sports chiropractic clinic run. I've been doing it for nearly 2 decades. It's because I follow these concepts. I'm not one of those, when you come in, you get the person just before you had. It's different every single time. It's a mini experiment. Every single visit, a patient comes to see me, and it's because of concepts like this. You have to have these ideas in the back of your head, or you're never going to be able to make the right decisions that get you a step ahead. So hope this stuff helps, guys. Appreciate you hanging with me today.